just from a strictly from a sort of business strategy point of view, it's not always smart to make the business so reliant on you. You know, you may be a huge Instagram influencer bringing down a lot of money through your influencer, you know, contracts. But what do you do when you want to sell that business? You know, that's a really hard business to get out of. It's a really hard business to, you know, cut back, because if you want to say like scale back your work, or you have a family or a kid, who's going to take over that role? So I have talked to a lot of those types of influencers about like, how can you sort of start to pull yourself back? You know, how can you supplement your business and make it a little bit more sustainable and not so reliant on like you as a person?
Hi, folks. It's the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Quiet Light Brokerage is the leader in helping entrepreneurs build, buy, and sell their online businesses. Since 2007, we have helped thousands buy and sell online businesses. And now, we're putting our extensive knowledge in your earbuds with our trademark relentless honesty and a few laughs along the way.
He broke up with you over text message?
It's kind of like firing someone over the internet.
And now, here's Joe and Mark.
Mark, one of the things that I think is a bit of a misnomer here about Quiet Light is people think that we do much more e-commerce physical product business brokering than we do content. And in fact, you know, the largest transaction I've ever done, the top two have been content and SaaS. And I understand you had a friend of yours, Bruno, from one of your mastermind groups on to talk about both that, just both content and a new SaaS business that he's got from his own content side. Can you chat about that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, Bruno, I love Bruno. The guy is an old school entrepreneur, and you know, I'm doing air quotes right now for old school, because in the world of the internet, is there an old school yet? But in my opinion, he's old school because the guy started out developing his own stuff. When he started his first business, Herbly.com, which is a home improvement blog, he developed the code himself, designed everything, and then was writing the blog post as well. And now that he's transitioning into a new SaaS product called Influence Kit, he's once again developing the code on the back end and doing pretty much everything on his own. And lives in that world of web development plus entrepreneurialism. Super, super smart guy when it comes to that side of it. So he and I, actually, this podcast is really just he and I catching up online and walking down memory lane. But there were a couple of things that came out of this I thought were fascinating. And one thing that I love about his business, Herbly, and there's a couple other guys that I talked to here local to me in the content world, is they're treating their businesses like influencers, and they actually talk about it as influencer marketing. And I don't know about you, Joe, but when I think of an influencer, I think of that, you know, 21-year-old model wearing sneakers and putting them on Instagram and getting paid just to post wearing those sneakers or something like that, right? The personality-based influencers. But what these guys are doing is they have their blogs, which are completely irrelevant to the personality. And I'm, you know, calling it a blog might be a little bit demeaning because it's so much more content than that. But these sites are influential. They have lots of followers for what they're doing. And large companies are coming to them and paying them to use their products and write about those products through their sites. So when you look at a content site, we often think, well, how do you monetize that? Well, there's AdThrive, there's Google AdSense, and you know, maybe you charge for advertising. Well, these guys are generating quite a bit more money by getting these sponsored posts. So Bruno and I talked a lot about that. We talked about how did he get into this in the first place with these sponsored posts? How did he attract some of these larger advertisers, which are obviously paying quite a bit to have these sponsored posts? But then we talked about his next venture, which is getting into that SaaS space. He realized that these companies that were paying him to do these sponsored posts, they wanted good metrics. They wanted to know how many people were clicking on the posts and reading them, how many people were sharing these posts. So he developed software internally for that reporting. Now he's developing a full-on SaaS product. And we talk about how do you grow a new SaaS business the right way, because everyone thinks, and I'm sure you've seen this, Joe, in the SaaS community, you kind of have this idea of, all right, you create your product, get the right fit, and then just scale, right? Well, not always, right? And he wants to make sure that he scales the right way and has the really good product market fit. So
Yeah, I think doing it slow and doing it right is much more important than trying to get big, too big, too fast, because you make mistakes and lose good customers along the way because they'll go somewhere else. I love the sounds of this because, as you said, most of the content sites that we've brokered are using AdSense and AdThrive and things of that nature. Even the largest one that I did was, and there's not a whole lot of sponsored posts that are driving revenue. So I think that's fantastic. And then love the offshoot of an entrepreneur telling his story or her story about how they had another business. And in this case, the SaaS product to serve those customers that were doing sponsored posts. So I think it's great. Let's go to it.
All right, Bruno, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate you taking the time here for a quick conversation. You and I are local to each other. We meet up once every few months with a couple other guys.
Yeah,
and just talk shop. So kind of weird to be talking to you.
I know. We should almost just get together in the same spot, right?
That would have been good planning on my part. And we know I don't do necessarily great planning all the time. So we have a little tradition here at the Quiet Light Podcast where we have our guests introduce themselves. We like to say it's because you know yourself better than I do, but really it's just because I don't do show prep. So
shoot, guess what? I didn't do any show prep either. So that's going to be a problem. I think I could probably introduce you better than me. So my name is, as you know, my name is Bruno Bornstein. I'm a local St. Paul guy like you are. And my background is in publishing online and web development. So I'm really a web developer who got into running, you know, digital content sites for a long time. So what that looks like is I launched a blog called Curbly.com in 2006 and another blog called Manmade DIY in 2010. I ran those for 10 years or more. And then in the last couple of years, I've been focusing on a new project called Influence Kit, which is a software as a service product that's targeted at digital influencers, you know, content creators, basically people like who I used to be.
Right. Now, you come from this kind of old school, or what I consider to be old school, internet entrepreneur. And I used to fall in this category. You know, the first business that I built online, I built the code and I built it in Perl, if you can wow. believe that. And I didn't know a lick of code, but I figured it out. You're still doing that to this day, though, right? I mean, Influence Kit, it's a SaaS product you're building. We'll talk about that in a minute. You're doing most of the development on that.
Yeah, I'm the lead developer for Influence Kit. I was also the lead, you know, the lead technical person for my content sites, which was good and bad. You know, there's upsides and downsides to being technical like that. I like you, learned to do a lot of this stuff a long time ago when the way that you learn to do web development was usually view source. So a lot of the things I learned was just by, you know, looking at another site, looking at the source, you know, trying to pick apart how it worked. Fortunately, that process has gotten a lot easier now. So there's a lot more resources out there for people to learn how to become web developers. But yeah, you know, I definitely like being involved in the technical side. I think a challenge for me is figuring out when to disengage from that and how much, you know, how much I should be involved and how much I need to try to delegate. So that's definitely something that I'm working on.
Yeah. All right. So I want to start out and I want to break this conversation into two parts. I want to talk about Influence Kit and what you're building there in the SaaS realm, but I want to talk also about Curbly and Manmade DIY. Is that right? Did I get that right?
Yep.
Okay. And you and also I know, you know, some of the other guys that we know have a model with their content sites. I think a lot of people, when they hear content sites, are just thinking, okay, I'm going to put something up. I'm going to put it on a passive ad network and just kind of run from there. But you guys do quite a bit more. Tell me a little bit about starting up Curbly and maybe the beginning story of that, and then what its primary means of monetization has been over the years.
Yeah, it's actually kind of an interesting story, right? Because it wasn't really intended to be a blog. The way Curbly came about was this. I was doing freelance web development. I took a contract building a social network. This was in like 2005. This was, you know, before Facebook was publicly available to everybody. You know, you still had to have an EDU address to get in. And this network that we built was intended to kind of like compete with that in some sense. After that project was done, I had some time on my hands, a little bit of money saved up. So a friend of mine and I decided to build something. And, you know, being the sort of non-strategic person that I am, we just kind of it was a little bit random. You know, I had bought a house. I was working on my house. That was kind of an area that interested me. So somehow, without a whole lot of forethought, we came on this idea of a social network for home improvement, right? The idea that Curbly was meant to be was a social network, UGC site, user-generated content site that all was focused around the home. Design, you know, I'm remodeling my kitchen. Here's pictures of what I want to do. I'm looking for ideas for my bathroom. Does anybody have some, you know, it sounds a lot like a site you've probably heard of, which is House, right? Like House is that. I think we wanted Curbly to be House. We just didn't really know it at the time. So what ended up happening was Curbly sort of organically transitioned into something else. We started the site, we built it, you know, really quickly in about 6 weeks, you know, the MVP of it. And the first thing was, well, we don't have any content on here. You know, how are people going to want to like join the social network when there's nothing there? So we just posted for, you know, freelance writers on Craigslist and had people start kind of seeding content. And that was not because we wanted to be a publisher or a media company, but because we just wanted something on the site. But over the years, you know, over the first 3 or 4 years, it just kind of, I realized that there was a business model there that was easier actually than trying to become House. And for a variety of reasons, you know, turning into House just like didn't happen. But learned that actually there was a way of generating high quality content for a reasonable price using freelancers and then monetizing that. So yeah, you know, over the course, you know, we were really lucky with Curbly. I think in our first month, we went from zero to 250,000 page views a month.
Wait, hold, what? How did you do that? Was that all organic SEO or were you keen in on other?
No, it was luck. You know, you gotta be lucky. We got on Dig. We got on, remember Dig?
I remember Dig. I got Dig to the front page maybe twice in my life.
Yeah, we got on Dig. We got on a few other things. Lifehacker, you know, was a big blog back then and they posted a link to one of our a project that somebody posted. Yeah, you know, it was just lucky. I talk about this a lot. Like sometimes, you know, if you had asked me at the time in November or December 2006, after Curbly had been live for two months, like how things were going, I would have said, I don't know, it's okay, not great. And I just think I talk to a lot of like younger entrepreneurs about this a lot, which is that at the beginning, it's really hard to know whether you're succeeding or failing, because especially if you don't have any experience. So the way I phrase that is success and failure look the same a lot of times when you're just starting out. And it's really about experience and context. So at the time, our goal was to build House, right? And so we wanted 250,000 users to sign up to Curbly, because that's, you know, active users was the metric we were looking at. And because we didn't have that, because we weren't seeing that, it was kind of like, ah, oh, what are we doing wrong? You know, it's not working. But not really appreciating that we had actually been really successful in another way that we didn't really understand. So I think for anybody who's, you know, is entrepreneurial, but maybe hasn't done a lot of things before, just remember that it may be very difficult to disentangle whether you're succeeding or failing. You might not have enough experience to really know the difference.
Yeah, I know with Quiet Light, it's the same thing, right? For the first like 5, 6, 7 years of Quiet Light, I did the same thing. And people would ask me like, well, what are your plans? I'm like, I don't know. You know, I might just make a boutique and not really do much more with it. Or I might just kind of wind it down over the next few years. But it just kept on kind of going and going and going. And it wasn't until really when I hired Jason on initially, Jason Yelowitz, that I was kind of like, there might actually be something here that I wasn't expecting. But you're right, success and failure do look the same. At the beginning, at least, they can look the same. When did you start taking on these sponsored posts? And just to be clear for everyone listening, you do have like AdThrive and stuff like that you monetize through, but a big bulk of your revenue is coming from getting sponsored posts from major companies like Home Depot's and other large companies that are looking at your traffic, at your audience, and saying, we want that audience. So we're going to pay you to test this product or to be able to feature this product in one of your DIY stuff. When did you start making that transition?
Yeah, 2009 was the very first sponsored thing that we ever did. So that was very early on. It was with a fabric company who I won't name, but it was kind of a failure for a variety of different reasons. But it was the first time we got paid just to create content, like on behalf of a brand. So, and then it ramped up, you know, so I would say, you know, in 2009, 0% of our revenue was sponsored content or influencer marketing, which is what it's kind of called now. And 100% was, you know, the rest, about probably 95% was programmatic display ads, and the rest was affiliate links. And then back then, you know, it was even okay to do text links, you know, that quickly went sour, but there was a period where it was okay to have text links on your site. And then, you know, probably by 2016, 50% of our revenue became sponsored content. So it did sort of take a little while to ramp up. And it took a while before we started seeing interest from, you know, established brands and agencies. But definitely by, you know, 2012, 2013, you were starting to get pitches from PR agencies, brands, ad agencies that were interested in partnering with you to talk about their products.
So what changed for those agencies to start recognizing you? Did you have to do outreach for that, or was it really just them picking up on the metrics that you guys were sporting at the time?
You know, I think a little of both. You know, I definitely started being proactive once I saw that there was an opportunity to make real money there. And so definitely being proactive, reaching out to people, even just replying. You know, we always got, as any kind of publisher, you're always going to get a lot of press releases and inquiries and people that want to talk, you know, want you to talk about their thing. So by proactive, I even mean just replying to those and saying like, hey, no, you know, we're not necessarily going to cover this product this month, but if you're interested in sponsored content, we have these opportunities. So just being like a lot more responsive and offering that. I think on their side, you know, they didn't really start seeing metrics until much later. Even today, a lot of influencer marketing happens with very little metric reporting, which is something that InfluenceKit is trying to change. But I don't know that it was that they started seeing big metrics. I think it was that the people that were working in those organizations like were more digitally native, like they understood that landscape more. You know, in 2009, I had people who didn't know what a blog was, right? Like there were still people who like were like, what's a blog? How do you make money on it? Why would a company pay to have their content on it or whatever? You know, by 2016, like that wasn't happening anymore. Everybody knew what a blog was. Everybody knew what social media was. And so the idea that a brand would want to communicate with your audience just made more sense. They understood that like, okay, blogs are a real thing. They have a real audience. They're communicating. They're able to communicate your message and help you get your branding out there. And so I think it just became a little bit easier to convince them of that.
Yeah, it reminds me of, do you remember Darren Rouse from ProBlogger.net? Yeah. He was kind of that big guy who was making all the push of saying, you know what, these blogs, you can actually make a lot of money with them.
Yeah.
Bit at the forefront of this movement. We're getting into this weird, wild world of influencer marketing, something which I know very, very little about personally. And I think one of the interesting observations here, and I'm sure a lot of the people listening are kind of like, well, yeah, of course, Mark, just kind of get with the program. But is the idea that, you know, I think that Instagram person, right, up on Instagram, and it's the person themselves, and they're making sure that all their pictures have the same colors in them and fit the 3x3 matrix that they want to have, so it looks all nice. But Curbly itself was the influencer in this situation.
Right.
And so you built a brand that was an influencer.
Yeah. Yes. So Curbly always was, you know, Curbly never had a, was never a personality driven site. And that helped us in some ways and hurt us in some ways. But yes, in our case, it was much more about the site than any individual person contributing to the site, because our site was driven by, you know, people, freelancers and a few staff people that were creating the content. But, you know, in general, there is much, you do see more of like the individual sort of pseudo celebrity influencer. Although, you know, there is a lot more out there than just that. There are a lot of sites out there that aren't so tied to the individual that's running them. That's really more about the content that they create and the audience that they are able to pull together.
Yeah, I mean, you think about like other guys we know over at Gear Junkie, right? Totally the same sort of thing where they can do that. And Bjork over at Food Blogger Pro as well, right? And all the brands that he and Lindsay have as well, which so influential for what they do.
I mean, I think, you know, a lot of bloggers and digital content creators that I talk to, this is a topic that comes up, because in terms of selling sponsored content, it can be easier if you are sort of a known personality. But in terms of actually having that be your business, not everybody wants to do that, because it is difficult to be that kind of an influencer. You really have to expose so much of your personal life and really be vulnerable. And that's not for everybody. Not everybody wants to do that. And then just strictly from a sort of business strategy point of view, it's not always smart to make the business so reliant on you. You know, you may be a huge Instagram influencer bringing down a lot of money through your influencer, you know, contracts, But what do you do when you want to sell that business? You know, that's a really hard business to get out of. It's a really hard business to, you know, cut back, because if you want to say like scale back your work, or you have a family or a kid, who's going to take over that role? So I have talked to a lot of those types of influencers about like, how can you sort of start to pull yourself back? You know, how can you supplement your business and make it a little bit more sustainable and not so reliant on like you as a person?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's the same advice that we would give anybody out there, is that I totally get the appeal of building a personal brand. And I think a lot of people start with that in mind, like, I'm going to build a brand around myself, I'm going to be the celebrity. But then you get to the point where like, this is a lot of work, and I've been grinding for 5 years, and I'm tired of posting my life for the public to see every single day. And so how do you convert that over to an actual business? It can be done. And I've seen a few cases where people have done it. Right. But it's a process.
It is. And it's, I just think it's something that, you know, because so many of these businesses do start off as hobbies or side projects, it's not something that people think about right away, but I think it is important to think about. You know, you need to start thinking about it as a business, building a team that can support you. You know, if you need to be the face of the brand, okay, that might be fine, as long as you are thinking about it and also thinking about how that might affect your ability, like I said, to sell the business or you know, change your involvement in the business.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about the influencer marketing side of it and the metrics. And this kind of moves into what you're doing now with Influencer Kit. You said yourself, there's not a lot of metrics that were necessarily expected from the people or even deliverable for the people that were paying for these sponsored posts. What have you done there, and maybe through Curbly, or that you've just kind of learned over the years is really helpful for somebody paying for a sponsored post to start to key in terms of those metrics?
Yeah, I mean, really where this came out of was, like I said, around 2016, we started doing a lot of sponsored content. And the first problem we had was just producing it efficiently, right? Not even reporting on it, but just like, honestly, making sure that we did everything we promised we would do. I mean, I know it sounds kind of silly, but when you're doing, you know, I think that year we were probably doing 3 blog posts a day on Curbly. We were doing something like 4 or 5 sponsored projects or, you know, campaigns a month on Curbly. It's just a lot of moving parts, you know, like, are we supposed to do Instagram for Home Depot, and how many pins were we supposed to do, and what was the blog post supposed to include, and is it the Home Depot or just Home Depot? I mean, these are all like little details, but it makes a big difference when you start working with those brands, because they expect a level of professionalism and you want to deliver that. So that was the first problem, is like, okay, we just don't have a good system for this. And that's kind of where the precursor to Influence Kit came. It was just an internal tool that I built to help our team, right? Just to help everybody keep on the same page. What do we have to do? You know, when is it due? Did we do it? Simple, right? And we used that. We used that tool for a long time. We used it both for our sponsored content, but also for our editorial, you know, planning. And it was great. It was really helpful. Then, you know, 2017, 2018, I started thinking like, man, we're just not doing a very good job of showing these sponsors the ROI of what we've did for them. You know, like, they're paying us money, we're getting, you know, good deals, we're getting as much money as we think we should be getting, we're creating this really good content, but that's kind of where it stops, you know? And I realized that was a weakness. And so then I started looking at, well, how can we report? How can we go back and report on this? Doing it manually, you know, sucks. And I am, you know, I'm somebody like, if I do something twice, I never want to have to do it again. You know, like, once I've done something twice, I'm like, okay, I should build something. So that's where Influence Kit came out of. And it really just lets you automate the reporting piece of that process. So that for us, you know, when we're doing, you know, say 4 sponsored campaigns a month, each of those campaigns might have 4 or 5 separate, you know, deliverables, things that we have to deliver back to the brand and report on. You know, that's 20 different things. We can just dump those all into Influence Kit and send the brand a report. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of where we're at now. The industry as a whole is really kind of still up in the air. People are starting to ask for a lot more metrics, but not all. And that's kind of part of my mission with Influence Kit is, you know, I want to see every blogger doing this. I think it's to their benefit. And I think that, you know, the biggest benefit is going to be when the industry realizes that there is reporting on this stuff, they're going to start opening the floodgates, right? And by that, I mean, there's going to be a lot more money coming in and available to do this kind of stuff, because they can actually measure the results.
let's talk about influence. And I love that, right? I love that the transition here, right? You've been doing content, sponsored posts, all this. And then internally, like you said, if you do something twice, you want to build a tool for it. And then you start building the tool and it starts evolving. And then next thing you know, you have on your hands what could easily become a SaaS application, which is what you are really focusing on right now. So you just finished, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you just finished a, kind of an introductory, like get in the door sort of program with Influencer Kit for a limited number of people, and you're in the testing stage with them right now. Is that right?
Yeah. So we're essentially in sort of like a pre-launch phase right now. We're letting in a very limited number of people. And that's really, that's not because, you know, we're snooty or anything. It's just, we're a very small team. It's myself and two other co-founders. And I think that, you know, we want to get it right. You know, we're trying to figure out, and I think all SaaS apps probably deal with this, but what's the growth rate that we actually think we can achieve and we actually can support? I think there might be a little bit of a misconception that you just like want to grow as fast as you can, as soon as you can, right? Like just grow. I don't know that I want to do that, you know? I want to grow this business at a rate that is sustainable, that we can actually keep up with. I don't want to be working nights and weekends right now. So yeah, where we are is we're letting people in. We're kind of testing out the product with them, making improvements and changes based on early customer feedback. And then, yeah, figuring out, okay, now what, right? Like we think we have product market fit. We spent about 6 months kind of convincing ourselves that that's the case. And now it's like, okay, well, how do we figure out how to grow? And like I said, at what rate we want to try to grow at?
So a couple of questions that kind of come to mind here. I'll ask the easier one first. And that is, you talk about not wanting to necessarily just grow as fast as you can and scale as fast as you can. What are some of the restraints that you're seeing? Like if you were to open it back up and, you know, our millions of listeners that listen to this podcast, and you start knocking on your door and they're like, hey, we want in, Bruno, we want in. What are some of the challenges that you guys would have in scaling quickly?
Oh, man. Okay, first of all, let's just back up and, you know, obviously it would be a great problem to have if millions and millions of people want to use it.
Problem to have millions of listeners as well.
You know, I'm not like that. So I don't want to just make that assumption. Obviously, we need to work really hard still to even have that problem. But what are the scaling problems? I think the first scaling problem would be people. SaaS apps, at least ours, I suppose I shouldn't speak for everyone's, but ours are still pretty heavily dependent on people. You really need to support people. You need customer support. You need onboarding. You know, there's still a lot of time that goes into it. And so that would be the first problem. So, you know, and then with that comes a bunch of other problems like scaling an organization, right? So like you're building a product, but you're also building a company. And in some sense, the company is like the more important product, because if you can build a good, solid organization, then you'll do other good things and good products will come out of that. So we're really trying to be conscious of that. Like, okay, if we suddenly had to hire 3 customer support people, like how would we do that? How would we train them? How would we all stay on task? So I think scaling up people would be a big constraint. From a tech point of view, for sure, there are some things we would run into as well. Influence Kit in particular relies on a lot of APIs. So, you know, and for the non-technical people, that just means we have to go out and grab stats from a bunch of different sources, Facebook, Instagram, Google Analytics, all that takes server time. All of those APIs have rate limits. You know, whenever you're building software, you know, doing something at a small scale and then just like growing it to a bigger scale is not as easy as just, it's not like a multiply things linearly. Things get way more complicated, way more difficult to debug. And that's not to say that I'm not excited about solving those problems. I am. But yeah, I want to do it in a sane way. You know, I think if we were to suddenly add, you know, if we were suddenly to triple our user base, like in a month, I would be spending a lot of late nights doing things that I don't want to be doing. So
I totally understand that. And the building the organization side, I think, is really important. Whenever you're scaling anything at all, having that foundation to be able to scale on is crucial, because you will just completely buckle under the weight of growing rapidly. Who's the client for Influencer Kit? Now, who are you trying to target? Obviously, digital creators would make sense, but it's not just mom bloggers.
So we think of our customer as professional bloggers. I know that when we started out, you kind of mentioned when you think of influencers, you think Instagram, and for sure, you know, that's legit. But as we talked about this a lot, you know, who we picture as our customer. It's somebody whose primary platform is content creation on a website that they own, and their social platforms are supplementary to that. And when I say professional, I mean like they're making their living off of this. Like they're supporting their family. They might even have an employee or two. You know, we look at it anywhere from there, you know, up to what you might consider more of like a small media organization, you know, a site that has 5 or 10 or 20 employees. Beyond that, we don't think about that really as our market so much, because at that scale, there are other tools for those people and we don't really want to swim in those waters. So that's really who we think about. The interesting thing is that we've started hearing from a lot of agencies and brands about this. Really not our plan, but what's happening is influencers are sending reports to their sponsors, the people who are paying them, and then we're hearing from them saying, can we use this? A great problem to have. It's a little bit like of an existential mini crisis for us, because we're all influencers. Like, we come from this background. We're bloggers. We set out really with a mission to build a tool to help empower people like us. And we don't want to just like, you know, pivot and start serving a completely different market. At the same time, you know, when you have people asking to use your thing and wanting to pay you, you need to listen. So we're trying to navigate that and see how we can do it.
That sounds like a really good problem to have, and sounds as well like you may be pivoting down the road into matching influencers as well. Not trying to plan your path for you, but just seems like a natural extension that might be happening as well. Cool. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast here, talking about some of these things. And I think we probably could have broken this up into two, because just thinking about all the questions to deal with on the SaaS side, if I asked another question now, we'd go on for 15 more minutes.
Okay.
So I'm going to stop it now, and I'm going to say, I want to have you back to check in as you get past that kind of first initial enrollment and talk about how things are evolving in this influencer space. I love the idea, and this thinking about influencers outside of the Instagram model, thinking about it more in terms of a brand, and just kind of the story as well is fantastic. So thanks so much for coming on.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for having me. I'd be glad to come on back, and can't wait to hear the episode.
All right. Looking forward to meeting up with you and the others again soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Mark.
Today's podcast was produced by Podcast Motor and the Quiet Light content team. If you have a suggestion for a future podcast, or if you want to guess the quote from the beginning of the show for a chance at getting a shout out on the pod, email us at podcast@quietlightbrokerage.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and this show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.